Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is James McManus, one of the top poker writers alive. He has two separate books you should read, Positively Fifth Street, which is about the 2000 World Series of Poker, and also Cowboys Full, which is the history of poker. Today we're talking Cowboys Full. This book has enough good stuff in it that we're covering it over two separate shows. James McManus final tabled at the World Series main event in the year 2000, earning almost $250,000. He's also a writer and a professor at the Art Institute of Chicago in the Masters of Fine Arts program. James McManus, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Okay, now, you're an English teacher and an English writer, and Cowboys Full is a history book. How did you happen to come writing a history book?
Well, I had written in Positively Fifth Street quite a bit of poker's history, especially as it had been played out in the 70s and 80s in Las Vegas, the No Limit Hold'em games. But writing that, I discovered that there was a much longer, deeper history going back to almost the beginning of the country. It comes into the United States in around the time of the Louisiana Purchase. And so my publisher and my agent and I decided that having sort of started it, I should finish the job. The problem was that, finish the job, that is, of writing the history of poker. The problem was that I was not a trained historian. I'd written long narratives. I knew some historical aspects of the story, but the skill required to write a history is different from writing narratives or poetry or short stories. And to make it even more difficult, my closest friend in the world, a professor named George Roeder, an American historian, who I had talked about, and he was a first reader of all my books, very helpful advisor to me. He had just died as I began the research on Cowboys Full, so that made it more of a challenge.
But you succeeded. This book actually has tons of footnotes and stuff in it, but it reads like a novel. So
there's a rich cast of characters.
It does.
There's a poker lore. The book kind of combines poker lore with poker history. A lot of, by the nature of the game, people not wanting to admit how much money they won for tax purposes or lost because it's embarrassing, it's very difficult to be precise about exactly what happened until the tournaments began being televised in the 80s and 90s. Since then, we know exactly what cards came out and who won what hand and how, what the prize money was. But when you go back to the early part of the 19th century, you're relying on hearsay, and there's not a lot of precision.
All right, so let's get started with how it is in the United States. About the time of the Louisiana Purchase, or maybe the War of 1812, and let's go to New Orleans. What was the status of poker then and there?
Well, New Orleans had been a city that was had been under Spanish and French flags until Jefferson figured out a way to purchase it along with the rest of the Louisiana territory from Napoleon. And so that a game that had been played called Poque, P-O-Q-U-E, a French game involving 20-card decks and 5-card hands, with no redraws, a very simple, elementary version of the game, was being played there. And the city became an American city overnight, as it were, the more English people began spending time in New Orleans and the South. And English Brag, which was played with a 52-card deck and had straights allowed for fluxes, what they called, or flushes and straights, that opened up the game and made it, the hands got bigger and more powerful, and there was more competition for the best hand, and the games grew exponentially larger in the first 30, 40 years of the 19th century. All beginning in New Orleans, and the games, many of the biggest games were played on the river boats going up and down the Mississippi from New Orleans.
So I'm guessing the river boats is how the game got spread.
Yes. That was the internet. The Mississippi River, and once we had steam power, the river system in the United States was effectively the internet of the early part of the 19th century. That's how goods, services, ideas, games, news, books, everything had to almost everything had to travel by river. Otherwise, it was by horseback or oxen or on foot. And the river system was enormously important in the development of the country.
And when did the deck shift from this 20-card game to the 52-card deck we know now, and from poke to poker?
That was happening 1815, 1828. It's hard to say precisely. It's certainly not, I'm not able to say precisely. But as the 52-card game, in which you could make many more hands with redraws, and so there was more betting and there was more greater possibility of making a lot of money, that game naturally became more attractive, and it moved up into the English-speaking parts of the United States. So I'm guessing by the time the armies of the Civil War, the soldiers are playing poker in the battle camps. They're playing with a 52-card deck, and the game involves straights and flushes.
And that was the game that evolved there was five-card draw?
Yes, but the original game, it was five-card no draw. In other words, you and I and Bob and maybe one other person would each be dealt five-card hands, and there would be one round of betting. Obviously, the best hand that you can make in that is four aces, but there was no way to tell how strong your opponent's hand was, and there was no chance of improving the strength of yours with a draw. So it was a radically less interesting game than the 52-card version, which had when Brag and Poker merged, and that game was called Poker. In the South, the pronunciation was Poker, and as it moved north, the R started being attached.
And when was the first writing about the game?
There are letters from that military men moving around in the western part of the South. I think as early as 1818, there's a letter from, and I don't have the pages in front of me right now, but military men moving from town to town along the river mention a game called poker in their letters. And then by the 1840s, congressmen and senators are playing, and there are newspaper accounts of it.
And the first book, like, to teach you how to play or with the rules?
I don't have the exact, I can't recall the exact books, but they start emerging soon after the Civil War.
Hmm. Who was George DeVol, D-E-V-O-L, and why do we know so much about him?
George DeVol was a riverboat gambler. Sometimes the stakes in his games involved the ownership papers to slaves, and he was a hustler. Back then, the best poker players were the best cheaters. Today, it's a skill game, having requiring that you understand psychology, mathematical odds, and so on. Back then, you won in the game by having the most elaborate way to get, say, a cold deck into a game, a deck in which your opponent would be dealt an extremely powerful hand, which for which he would be willing to lose all of his money on, and you would have a slightly better hand. So the app poker skill in large money games was much more about a sleight of hand, Confederates standing behind players, sending signals with smoke rings or the angle of the cane. They would people standing behind your opponent would give you information about the strength of his hand. Mirrored rings, elaborate devices to move a card up and down your sleeve so it could introduce it into your hand at a key moment. And Duvall was one of those players. And he made and lost a gigantic fortune. Eventually, he's chased out of the game because, obviously, honest players wanted to do everything they could, including kill suspected cheats. So a career such as that could be very, very lucrative, but in the long or even medium term, your life expectancy is going down all the time.
And Duvall wrote a book explaining his exploits. And
40 years a gambler. And that's a book that's available on Amazon, and I recommend that people either go get that book and check out his stories, or in my history you can read summaries with examples of some of his craftier adventures.
Back in New Orleans is one of my favorite places to visit. Back when Harrah's had good games, I picked up a license plate size sign that says all gamblers and fancy women must sign up with the captain before the boat leaves for New Orleans. This was put out by the Mississippi Riverboat Owners Association.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect it's of modern vintage, but it did strike my fancy, although my wife just can't seem to find a good place to hang it up. She just doesn't think that's an appropriate thing in her house. So, oh well.
I would hang that in mine.
You would hang that in your house?
I would, yeah. And along with my other favorite, which is an old hotel sign that used to say, no dogs or actors allowed.
yeah,
for a long time, being an actor was the lowest form of entertainer. Today, we twist ourselves into pretzels to get within 100 feet of them, but that was Casanova's original job. He was an actor, and it was a career that you had cause to be embarrassed about.
Yeah,
I'm. I like the sign that Max Rubens used to have at his old house. It was from a W.C. Fields movie, I think it was My Little Chickadee, that said something on the order of, anything worth having is worth cheating for.
It's only very recently that poker is considered a legitimate strategic game involving skill and luck. Back then, it was an occasion for one blackleg cheating another.
And do you know where that term came from, blackleg?
As I understand it, it was the costume of these riverboat gamblers, that they wore long stovepipe narrow pants, and the favorite color of their costume was black.
All right, so Cowboys Full is a history book, but it reads like a novel with wonderful turns of phrases. One phrase I objected to was when you were talking about playing poker during the Civil War, And you wrote, quote, "Since inadvertent marks were unavoidable in even the squarest of games, recognizing the creases or smudges on the backs of particular cards gave substantial advantage to those with a cheating heart to go with above average eyesight." Unquote.
That's the best. That's the best sentence in the book. What's wrong with that?
Now, obviously, intentionally creating those marks and smudges would today fall under the category of cheating.
Right.
But if the marks are already there, recognizing and taking advantage of them is playing the game intelligently, not evidence of having a cheating heart, at least to my mind. Am I misunderstanding what you wrote or meant?
I would say the sentence assumes that the marks were introduced intentionally. I agree with you that if there's a mark that you know to be an ace and you notice that mark in your opponent's hand and refuse to call his bet, that would not be cheating. But I think what I was implying was that the marks had been brought in, had been made on the card on purpose.
Yeah, although during the war years, I'm sure those decks got beat to hell. And anybody who took the time to really study them, I'm sure had a big advantage.
A huge advantage. And there were so many marks, so the quality of the paper, you know, today's cards are plastic, and they're pretty hard to dent them, and once you've got a little nick in them, they immediately are removed from the game. Whereas back then, the cards were much lower quality, and they would be used over and over and over again. And the problem would be more which you'd have to decipher your identifying nick or mark amid 20 or 30 of them and other parts of the back of the card. So eyesight would be tremendously important, especially in dimly lit rooms. You know, these rooms were not brightly lit with electricity. They were lit with candlelight.
Yeah, I'm about the same age as you are, Jim. And when we played cards as kids, we certainly used the same decks over and over and over and over again.
Right.
At the time, I wasn't clever enough to realize that reading the marks, that the marks were clearly there, and reading them would give me an advantage. Of course, we weren't playing for stakes other than, ha-ha, I told you so. And and I was one of the better players anyway. But it never occurred to me at the time to read the back.
My memory is such that if I did do that, I have forgotten it. And we played for what were considerable stakes. We used to play for pennies, nickels, dimes, quarters, and sometimes dollars in, you know, 1965, 66, 67. So that was, people were winning $10 or $15 a game. That was a huge amount of money. It would take you weeks to make that in the kind of jobs that high school kids were able to get.
Yeah, and in the mid-60s, I would think the minimum wage was a buck and a quarter. But
So $15 is a lot of money to win. And I remember, and you would come home if you were a winner. You would come home with your the pockets of your jeans stuffed full with hard cash, not
with
dollar
coins.
Bills. It would all be coins, and you sort of empty it out.
I certainly remember walking home with a pocket full of coins.
Right, and feeling pretty flush.
Yes, or in my case, feeling pretty broke. Poker was never my best game. In the early 1800s, five-card draw poker was the main game. Today, it's Texas Hold'em. Somewhere along the way, five-card stud and seven-card stud had their heydays. Take us through that shifting popularity of these games, if you can.
Well, five-card stud the game that Doc Holliday and a lot of the people in the second half of the 19th century are playing, was considered the most skillful game and the game that required you to make the most interesting deductions. If you could deduce based on betting patterns what your opponent's single hole card was, there would be, you could win a lot of money that way. But seven card stud gave you many more opportunities for skill to be in play. Two hole cards, four cards dealt face up, and then a seventh card dealt face down made the game much more complex. And that was the more complexity there was, the more skill there was involved. So that contributed heavily to the popularity of stud throughout the 19th century and then well into the 20th century. The speculation, and for which there is considerable evidence, is that sometime in the early 20th century, around 1920-25, in Texas, there were enough players to sit down to a stud game, and indeed that there were more than enough players, so that there were more players than could be dealt seven card hands. Say there were 9 or 10 of them, and somebody came up with the idea, because there were already games in which community cards existed, that if the four board cards or the five cards that would be in individual hands could be shared, that would be a way for more players to be able to participate in a game. And that game was called Hold Me Darling, played in Dallas, Oklahoma, North Texas, and eventually moves its way out to Las Vegas. And that in the process, Hold Me Darling was abbreviated to Hold Me and then Hold 'em. And that was the game that Hold 'em came to dominate the poker world, mainly because it was the game that was chosen by Benny Binion, Ted Binion, and Johnny Moss to be the game that decided the main event of the World Series of Poker in 1970. So since then, if you play in a high-stakes game of poker, especially tournament poker, No Limit Texas Hold'em is by far the most common variant of the game to settle a tournament.
And it's the most popular game in Las Vegas currently as well, but that didn't mm-hmm. really happen until probably the Chris Moneymaker 2003 or whatever.
My sense from having played out there in the 90s was that Hold'em was the most popular game, certainly in California.
Southern but it was California. Limit. It was all limit Hold'em back then.
Okay. Your memory is better than mine, but now that you say it, there was much more limit Hold'em back then. That game
yeah.
has virtually disappeared, but you're absolutely right, is that limit Hold'em was the main event was no limit Hold'em, but people played a lot of cash games with limit Hold'em, and the first modern advice books about how to make money in the game, Sklansky's books on Texas Hold'em, were primarily about limit Hold'em. So that's a good point.
Yeah, and it really changed in, I think, in 2003 after Chris Moneymaker won, and then
mm-hmm.
suddenly...
Right, and he did it on television. It's not only that he won, but he beat a famous pro at his own bluffing game, and he did it on ESPN.
Yes,
And Hold'em is also much more telegenic than stud is, because in Hold'em, the community cards are sitting right in the middle of the table above the logo of the sponsor of the tournament. And the camera doesn't have to show the four board cards of six or seven stud hands. The efficiency and the small compactness of the information. Everybody's got the two hole cards. And then the other factor in moneymakers triggering that explosion is that that was the first time that a World Series of Poker event had been televised with the hole cards showing.
Right.
Before that, people like to say that watching Hold'em, watching poker professionals play was like watching bears hibernate and smoke, because they were so good at not revealing the strength of their hand with their eyes or their mannerisms. And if you're watching, why would anybody want to watch poker if you didn't know who was bluffing and who was holding the nuts? So that combination of a telegenic game, the ability to bluff being so much more powerful because of the no limit structure, and the televised factor on a sports network was a deadly storm.
In many ways, Omaha is a more interesting game, where you get four individual cards instead of two. Is that too complicated for television?
The executives who make these decisions want. I agree with you that Omaha is a vastly interesting game. If you have a gambling spirit, that's the game for you to play, because you've got six hands to consider in your six two-card hands in your hand with the four hole cards. But TV likes it simple, and they don't like to have to educate people. And the rules, in other words, if you only have an ace of hearts but no other heart, in Hold'em, if there were four spades on the board, you would have a flush. In Omaha, you don't. So it's that extra level of complexity and extra rules that I think the average member of the audience might find a little bit too complex. There, of course, on small podcasts, people play Omaha, and it's broadcast effectively. But if you're going for a vast audience in the November sweeps, you want to keep it to the simplest game, the most telegenic game. And I think that's why Hold'em continues to be pretty much the only game that you see on TV, much to the chagrin of people of old stud artists. Not all of them are old, but stud tends to be played by members of the older generation. And, you know, that's a beautiful game that requires much more memory, and a lot of people say is much more complex.
I'd most like to see is the horse event, you know.
Sure.
To me, that's really about who's the best player.
Well, that is the game. Certainly, the $50,000 mixed game event at the World Series, the Poker Players Championship, involves not only horse, but Badugi, Badesi, No Limit Hold'em, Limit Hold'em, Omaha, Omaha High Low, Stud, Stud High Low. I think they're currently playing nine games. And among the cognoscenti, among the people who play professionally, that game clearly requires the most skill. But you can't win as much money at that game because there's just not as many people willing to sign up. That's the game in which the pros have a huge edge. The luck factor in No Limit Hold'em allows more people to sign up. And it's sort of like chess. Nobody's lining up around the block to play the current world champion of chess and put up $10,000 for the right to play against. Everybody knows who's going to win that match, and the pros are going to win the mixed game events almost without exception.
Yes, the winners of that have been pretty good. There was Chip Reese and Andy Block and Scotty Wynn and whoever else since then, but it's pretty well-known players.
And the trophy that you get for winning it, the Chip Reese trophy, is named after him because he is commonly thought of to be the most skillful poker player. People usually mentioned Stu Younger as the best no-limit hold'em player, but the all-around game, all the variants of poker, Reese was probably the best player.
And since they're both dead, nobody's going to be able to pass that in people's memory. Now, the book, Cowboys Full, it includes several short vignettes about people who helped shape the way we look to poker, including Wild Bill Hickok, Mark Twain, several presidents, and others. One extended vignette in your book is a name many of our listeners will not be familiar with. He's an exceptional, albeit flawed man, with some good luck and bad luck along the way. Please tell us, Professor McManus, about Herbert Yardley. And since he's
Herbert?
Worth it, give us 5 or 8 minutes on that if you can.
Herbert O. Yardley, the author of The Education of the Poker Player. He is an Indiana farm boy, football player, who loves playing poker in the evening and doesn't take it casually. He's determined. He studies the game. He gets primers about how to play, and he deals out many, many practice hands in which he plays different strategies and sees which ones lead to the best results. And he's such a good player that he wins enough money to attend the University of Chicago. And while there, from that point, he gets a job as a cryptographer in World War I. And he is charged with breaking codes, the Japanese code and the German code. And he is the first example of sort of an intellectual player who figures out how to use analytical skills, code reading, and basic poker acumen in order to do things like end wars or end those wars more quickly. His skill in breaking codes in the First World War leads him to be hired by the Chinese during the beginnings of the Second World War, the Chinese-Japanese War, and he's breaking codes on the side of the Chinese, and they're paying him massive amounts of money to do that, and he's playing in high-stakes poker games with other spies and cryptographers, and at one point he is the other side finds out who he is. The German and Japanese counter spies, and they put out a contract on his life, and he needs to leave the country, but the Chinese don't want to let him go because he's so valuable for their war effort, and he's able to predict by breaking the code when the bomb runs are going to come over various cities in China, and they're not going to let him leave. And he has to bluff his way out of the country by telling them that he will reveal their own codes if they don't let him fly out. And that's how, and the bluff works, and he's able to leave the Chinese city in order to avoid being assassinated himself. And that's all before the Second World War starts. And in the Second World War, he's even higher up in the intelligence services. But his problem is that he likes to brag. He's a very good poker player, he's a very good code breaker, but he's a little bit loose with the information. So he doesn't get promoted as high as far as he would have been if he was more discreet. So it's the British who break the German code with some Yardley help, although he's not at the very highest echelons. And he ends World War II his reputation, he's known for indiscretion, but he's also known to be quite brilliant. After the war, he comes back, and he's unable, because of his indiscretion, he's not able to get the government jobs that he would have had if his reputation was more sterling. So he becomes a poker player, and he ends up writing the key book of the mid 20th century about poker, how the education of a poker player, which combines his experiences playing in Indiana, in China, in Europe, all over the world, with advice about how to play the most popular games at that time. It's the first primer that goes out to the masses. A shortened version of it is published in the Saturday Evening Post, and this is in March of 1957, I believe, and that issue outsells all their previous issues on the newsstands. The book comes out, it's a bestseller, and it's important for us because it's the first time that skill, the use of skillful tactics, solid, sound betting advice, when to fold, when to raise, is made to seem more important than cheating. It's sort of the imprimatur that poker is a game of skill that is legitimate, that it's quite family friendly, but that it's a game that honorable men play well. And so from 1957 forward, poker's reputation is very different in no small part due to Yardley's work.
It's a really great book. For people who haven't read it, it's well worth it. The poker advice is not particularly good, but the stories about, you know, his code breaking in China are just great.
Yeah. The story of playing, how when he's coming up, he's learning from this guy who is not only the proprietor of the poker parlor, but he is the enforcer, and how he deals with cheaters, the amounts they play in games in which it's before the rule of table stakes comes into play. Table stakes is you can only bet in a hand what you have on the table before the hand begins. Yardley played in games in which people could bring the deed of their farm into the middle of a pot. You know, the pot's already, say, $4,000 or $5,000, and they've got the deed to their farm, which is worth $10,000. They can raise something, and these are games in which people go entirely broke on one hand.
Yeah. So if I have a deed to my farm, put it in the table. How the hell do you know it's $10,000?
Yeah, that was another problem of playing open stakes as opposed to table stakes.
Now, the education of a poker player, you borrowed that title. And
only
a couple of years ago, you turned it into a title of interrelated short stories.
It's kind of a coming-of-age novel told in short stories.
Uh-huh.
And the reason that it's called The Education of a Poker Player is that I received that book myself on my 13th birthday from my grandparents. And I had two sets of grandparents, and one of them taught me how to play poker, and they took me to the track, and they encouraged me to enjoy those kinds of things in life. And the other side of my family, including both of my parents, were very, very chagrined. They thought it was a mortal sin to gamble, let alone to do it on a professional basis. So the battle lines were drawn when Yardley's book arrived at my house from my mother's parents, and that's sort of the centerpiece of the book. So that's why it was called my book is also called The Education of Poker Player. Obviously, I'm also tipping my hat to Yardley.
You are, and I have read the book. I enjoyed it. It's the poker is a part of the book.
Right.
Certainly, our listeners shouldn't be
looking to that book as a lot of poker advice. I was about the same age as you, although I grew up in Los Angeles rather than Chicago. And I was in a Protestant family, and in your book, being in a Catholic family, figures prominently. But I related to a lot of the stories you told. I enjoyed it, being 13 and horny all the time.
Right. Right.
We didn't call it a doozer, but I figured out what that was. I enjoyed that book.
Right. Thanks. Yeah, you're right in pointing out that there are 7 stories in the book, and only 3.5 are all about poker. The rest of the book has to do with poker is seen as kind of the antithesis of becoming a priest. And my family was very interested in the firstborn son, that being me, becoming a priest, because they believed that if any member of the family was a priest, everyone got a straight dispensation from, you couldn't go to hell or purgatory. When you died, you'd go directly to heaven. So in their minds, and in my mind until I got a little bit older, it was kind of a life or death matter in the afterlife. You could save thousands and thousands or millions of years of being burned in purgatory simply by having a brother or the son or the grandson become a priest. So there was the battle lines were drawn, and there was a lot at stake. I no longer believe that their souls were at stake, but at the time they and I believed that if I quit my path to the priesthood and became a poker player and among other things, that there was going to be a lot of pain and suffering as a result. It's amazing for me to look back at that and actually believe that we all believe those things.
Yeah, I had never heard that one, that the whole family gets a pass. That's
right, right. That came from my grandma. My father's mother believed that. She had been raised as a very devout Catholic. She worked. She was the secretary of the parish priest, the guy who ran our parish, and she was completely devoted to the notion that I needed to become a priest. And poker was seen as poker and smoking cigarettes were the very antithesis. Drinking beer, playing poker, girls, all of those things were the spelled doom for the family, not only for my soul, but for the entire family's soul. Pretty spooky.
Well, in the book, you have her smoking Kent cigarettes all the time. So
yeah,
okay for her, but not for you.
Yes. Smoking was much more acceptable than drinking, but the most egregious sin you could commit was premarital sex or poker. So that by the time I was 13, 14, 15, those were my job one. Those were the most important polls, and so there was a lot of consternation as I went from being an altar boy to a poker player who liked girls.
Yeah, I guess my favorite story was Picasso in there, but I'll leave that to other people to read that. It was a fun little read there. All right.
Yep.
Now, Las Vegas poker players back in the 70s and 80s had a reputation of cheaters and colluders. It is said that Doyle Brunson and Chip Reese, two of the oldest, best, and most respected players, got together and got the others to agree that no more cheating would take place. This was not done on moral grounds, but rather cheating was hurting business. Now, you didn't address this specifically in your book. In your research, did you run across this? Was it part of lore or history or anything like that?
I report that Johnny Moss was widely suspected of cheating. This was the trickiest aspect of the book that I had to report. And since I was able to have conversations with people like Chip and Doyle, I never asked them those questions, in part because I didn't necessarily expect to get a clear answer. It was such a fraught subject. But I do know that by the time that I started playing in the World Series around, not around, in the year 2000, there was cheating was looked down upon. That there were some people were suspected of cheating, but the general vibe in the room at the Horseshoe was that cheating was not a good thing, and that it would be dealt with swiftly and terribly. You know, the Horseshoe, the Horseshoe didn't call the cops on people. The Horseshoes meted out the security at the Horseshoe meted out justice in person, and it could be severe. So I may have seen cheating, but I didn't recognize it. But by the 21st century, poker had high stakes tournaments being observed by so many people with cameras, film cameras, still cameras, changing the deck every 20 or 30 minutes. Cheating had pretty much disappeared, as far as I could tell. Now there may have been collusion among players, but as the tournaments got big, you know, when there's only seven people playing in the main event of the World Series, the possibilities of collusion are much more likely. However, by the time the tournaments start getting bigger, with hundreds of people signing up, 512 in 2000, which broke all their records by, I think the previous record was 375, and they went to 512. By that point, if the opportunities to collude against your fellow players didn't entirely disappear, but they were minimized.
Well, also, if cheating was going to go on, the tournament would probably not be the place to do it, just because,
exactly,
you know, it's so long and there's so much luck involved. You know, in my book, Doyle did tell a story of Johnny Moss cheating, which I was kind of surprised, actually, that he told the story, but of Moss using a peak in the old Flamingo, and he had to leave Las Vegas for quite a number of years. He was afraid to come back. It's quite a story, because he comes in with a shotgun to get his buddy out that they had caught. But Bob, when you say that it was that there was no moral grounds, actually, there was a period back then when both Chip and Doyle became born-again Christians. And, you know, so that also had something to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably true.
Yeah, I'm sure it was, you know, like any complicated long-term decision or evolution, there's a variety of factors involved. You know, all of a sudden you get religion in a smaller sense or in a more general sense, and you're less inclined to be behave immorally. And it's also, if too many people believe there was cheating in the big game, they'd have nobody to play against. So a variety of factors would contribute to that. But I think the main contributors to that was that most of the high-stakes games in Las Vegas were played in public in card rooms that had cameras, and the dealer was changed every half hour or so along with the deck. So it just became increasingly difficult to cheat. Now that most of the cheating, as I understand it, is taking place online, because people can much, much more easily collude with their computers, and also they can write programs that a robot would play their hands for them. Even if they're no longer, you know, monitoring it, they could just set it up to play. So more and more people, among the people that I play poker with, avoid serious playing for serious money online even before Black Friday, because it was you never knew what you were up against.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about Black Friday in our second Cowboys full interview. But necessarily, Cowboys Full talks a whole lot about the World Series of Poker. Now, you went through several final tables of the main event and along with a couple others, but you skipped some of them entirely. How did you choose which ones to write about and which ones to let go?
Well, in the first place, I didn't think I could end the book, you know, right from 1970 through 2009 exclusively about the World Series. It is the version of the game that by far the most people followed. But I wanted to also tell other things that were happening in the poker world at that time. The rise of internet poker, poker as it was played in Vietnam, and I probably the biggest factor in deciding which final tables were reported and which weren't were the ones that I had where my research was richer. In other words, for the year that Tom McAvoy won, I knew one of the dealers, Pamela Shondell, and she was a photographer, and she had a treasure trove of pictures from that year, some of which made it into the book. And she had it. So also when you have pictures, you can tell who was sitting where at a table, so that would give me richer fodder from which to make a chapter about that year as opposed to another year. Much of the book from these sections of the book originally came out in Card Player, serialized between 2000 and 2000 and I'm sorry, between 2005 and 2009. So I'm writing the chapters as also articles that were illustrated. And you know, when I have Crandall, when I finally reach Crandall Addington, the old Texas road gambler, the you know, but if I score an interview with somebody, that the tournament, the action that he was involved in, I was able to write much more fully.
Now, we could spend all day telling World Series of Poker stories. We won't. Do you have some favorite ones?
Well, to be honest, the favorite one is the year I almost won. That's basically the entire story of Positively Fifth Street. I think the one I don't know if you want to hear that one or you just want to send. I certainly recommend that readers check out Positively Fifth Street because it's an account. Should I do that one? Can I talk about that one?
Well, no. We're actually going to be having a whole show on Positively Fifth Street.
Right.
In the year 2000. And so, but if you don't have
one.
A story to tip, okay.
Well, I think to me, one of the most impressive feats in card playing lore is the way that Stu Unger, the fanatical gin player and sports gambler, arguably the most talented gin player who ever played the game, so good that he eventually couldn't get any action. He couldn't get people to sign up to play against him for serious money, even if he spotted them a peek at the bottom card in the deck. So his action in this area dries up. Obviously, he's not going to win in sports betting because almost nobody can beat that game. So he needs to suddenly learn No Limit Hold'em because that's the game in which you can win the most money. And he goes from gin, which requires a picture-perfect memory in order to dominate in, to he switches to No Limit Hold'em because that's where you can win $1 million in a tournament or a large figure, not quite $1 million. And he, in a matter of months, turns himself from a rookie to the most dominant player, No Limit Hold'em tournament player in the world. And then you know, he eventually loses all of his money because he's got a drug habit and he's got a sports gambling problem. But the way he won the 1982 and 83 World Series, when he was basically learning on the job, I think is probably the most startling series of events in the World Series history.
And then came back later to win it a third time.
Right. Come back. His nostrils are almost non-existent because of how much cocaine he's been snorting. And he comes back in, I guess that was 1997, 15 years later, and in really bad physical shape, and he manages to win a third time. The only person who's ever won the World Series main event three times. Truly phenomenal. Right. Card sense.
We're talking to Jim McManus, author of Cowboys Full. We're going to do a brief commercial, and then when we get back, we're also going to talk about the time that Stewie Unger might have won actually a fourth bracelet, but and what happened there.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. From Monday through Thursday throughout April, you may earn free buffets. Play 300 points and swipe before 2 p.m. to earn a lunch buffet. A total of 600 points is required for a dinner buffet, whether you've already picked up the lunch buffet or not. Buffets are good Monday through Thursdays, do not have to be used the same day earned, and they all expire on May 4th. One nice feature, they will allow you to use multiple coupons in your name to bring guests, and they will let you use your coupons for lesser meals. For example, if I played Monday and Tuesday, I could use all four coupons to take three friends to lunch. The free senior tournaments are now on Mondays. You get one free entry just because, and you earn up to two more by paying 300 points each. So if you're playing for the buffets on Monday and you're of age, you'll get the tournament entries for no extra play. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is 10 play with Dream Card. Dream Card is a 10 coin per line bet, or periodically you receive a dream card, which almost always turns into the best available card given the other four. Occasionally it's not the best, so you need to be alert. There's no special strategy for dream card. If you know the base game, you know how to play dream card. Playing in the dream card version will always slightly increase your EV and will also increase your variance.
Okay, we're back talking with Jim McManus. Now, there was one time Stewie had a real big stack, and then he didn't show up to play. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, he was high. He was in no shape to even sit up and stand up and walk across the room. Couldn't get to the table. Billy Baxter had backed him, put up $10,000 plus all of Stu's expenses, and he's got a massive chip lead. On the back then it was a 4-day tournament, and on the end of day three he had a very commanding lead, and he never ends up in the emergency room and never quite makes it to the final table to sit down. Although his chips stack, as he's being blinded off, is large enough that he still finishes, I believe, fifth that year. So Billy Baxter I believe it was
Sexton.
Mike Sexton. We're trying to shake him together, get him alert enough to play. But they had succeeded in doing that many previous times, but not this time. And he actually could have won a fourth, which would have been obviously even more mind bending. To have won three is quite remarkable, and a fourth, and who knows how many more he could have contended with or actually come out and won if he was of clear mind and sound body. very sad story. Stu Unger's story is pretty inspiring in terms of the skill level, but in terms of how it turns out for the individual guy and his family, very tragedy.
Yes,
one of the
somehow.
World Series that was quite unusual was the second one. I believe it was the second one, the one where Amarillo Slim won.
Yes.
There was some talk that they decided he should be the winner. Doyle apparently didn't want to win because he thought it would hurt his business, that people wouldn't want to play with him if he won.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you know more about Doyle's history, poker situations back then, but certainly there was a lot of enthusiasm for Slim because he was a raconteur. Johnny Moss is not the kind of person who can go on The Tonight Show or a late evening talk show and publicize the game. Whereas when Slim won, he and Benny Binion went on all late evening talk shows and promoted the game, and they effectively gave hour-long commercials for the horseshoe in the World Series because Slim was a born storyteller. And Slim was much more important, even though he won it only 1 year. He was one of the great raconteurs of the game. And
certainly I remember him on Johnny Carson and other shows, and it was one of the things that really sort of kindled my imagination about gambling and coming to Vegas.
Right. He raised the profile of poker, Hold'em, the horseshoe, and the World Series more than anybody. His ending was pretty sad, but at the time in the early 70s and throughout, he was the game. He was. There are many differences between Slim and Daniel Negreanu, but Daniel is one of the game's most effective promoters these days, and Slim filled that role. You know, a natural talker, ebullient personality. The first year I played in 2000, he stood with a big butcher knife across his throat, threatening to cut his own throat, as he had promised to do. He was standing above Kathy Liebert, and he said, "If a woman ever wins the World Series of main event, I'll cut my own throat." And so he was just a natural showman.
He reminds me more of Phil Hellmuth than Daniel Negreanu.
Yeah, Phil. Yeah, Phil's a sterner presence at the table. You know, when Phil's away from the table commentating, he's a wonderful guy. He hosts charity tournaments better than anybody I've ever seen. They're both big, rangy guys, Phil and Slim. Slim reminded me more of Daniel because they're both such great talkers.
Yeah. Why did you say Slim's ending was sad?
Oh, Slim.
There was accusations of child abuse, sort of.
I don't really want to get into it. People can Google that. I certainly don't know what the facts are, but there were some unhappy revelations or allegations toward the end of his life. He was he couldn't keep his hands off women, and that led to many extremely unfortunate situations, even within his own family.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's too bad.
All right. We've been talking to Jim McManus, author of Cowboys Full, The History of Poker. This is going to conclude part one of talking about this book. We're going to do a part two sometime in the very near future, which is a continuation of where this book left off. If you liked today's show, pretty sure you're going to like the next one as well. Thank you, Professor McManus. This has been fun. Thank you, Richard.
I look forward to the next section, and I'll talk to you folks soon.
All right. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.